Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is The Promise of Tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of The Promise of Tomorrow.
Thank you much for being with us once again as we explore an exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, energy, all right here in the Science News Radio Network. Today we're going to get right to our lead story here, and a dramatic increase in battery capacity, 40% increase in battery capacity. And then Tom Beckwith is coming by with electronic controls that dramatically save energy in electricity distribution. And then Peter Rubin is going to explain his process for capturing energy from wasted thermo. That's going to be pretty fascinating too. And we'll visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and of course at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, I want to get our first guest on the line and hear about these exciting battery advances. All right, right now I want to introduce you to Jürgen Hoffler. He's Vice President of Engineering and Operations at Nanosys. Nanosys does some pretty high efficiency products in some of the world's largest markets, including solar and light-emitting diodes, memory, semiconductor, and display, and a lot of different things. But today we want to talk about advances in batteries. Welcome to the program, Jürgen.
Hi, Colonel Mason. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's good to have you. Now, I understand, we've been talking about on this program about the slow progress of the advancement of batteries, and about how it's so badly needed to bring them around faster. And you, at your organization, have come up with some ways of really improving battery performance. Can you, as much as 40%, I understand, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Can you...
In fact, we developed an anode material for lithium-ion batteries that, as you mentioned, increases capacity of the battery by about 40%, and that corresponds to a step function improvement compared to the normal 5-6% year-over-year improvement that you have in the battery technology. So bringing that improvement to the market, I think it will have a big impact on usability of appliances, from small appliances ranging from cell phones all the way eventually to cars and EVs.
Well, I understand the lithium-ion battery market is expected to be greater than $70 billion a year within the next 10 years or so. Tell us about this remarkable improvement in battery performance, 30 to 40%. How are you able to do that?
Nanosys is a company that makes architected materials, which means we are... designing materials bottoms up, so we essentially take atoms atom by atom and then assemble them into new materials. That allows us to tailor the properties of those materials much better to the intended uses than if you take a naturally occurring material and then try to modify it by grinding it or chemically altering it and so on. So our approach is, in all our products, that we try to use existing processes, so that is methods that companies use to make their products, and keep them pretty much unchanged, so there's no additional investment in CapEx equipment necessary for companies, as well as no deep changes to their processes. So it's basically a drop-in. And if you do that and you get... with our new materials, then a much improved performance. I think that's a win-win for both us and our customers.
So you don't actually make the batteries. You work with the manufacturers of the batteries to improve the output of the efficiency of the battery. Is that right?
Absolutely. So we work on the starting materials, in this case anode material, and we don't intend to gain all the expertise that the battery manufacturers already developed in years, as well as the investments they have in their factories. So our strength is really providing the starting materials and get improved performance that way.
Well, what's really interesting to us is you're using nanotechnology to do this. Is that correct, isn't it?
That's absolutely correct.
So this is a real big breakthrough then in nanotechnology.
It is. So you may know that Nanosys was founded in 2001, then on the premise of utilizing the potential that was in the news and known everywhere that nanotechnology may yield for society. And we went about to figuring out what those potential applications could be. So we spent 7-8 years in directed research and built on an initial patent portfolio that we out-licensed exclusively from a number of research institutions that worked on nanotechnology, like MIT, Berkeley, mm-hmm. and others. And we succeeded in isolating the cases that had immediate return for us. So we identified markets that were in need of new materials and processes that would be compatible with our materials, and of course products that provide market pull, so there has to be an economic component as well.
Now, do I understand it's going to be 2011, next year, when the commercialization is expected, that we can go out and buy batteries with this new process? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's correct. Right now, we are working with several partners who do testing on our batteries, or the batteries they build with our materials. And so we're talking about tens of thousands of components that need to be reliability tested in long-term tests that they perform. So safety has, of course, is highest priority, and it'll take, depending on the product, between 6 to 12 months or so to qualify those batteries then with their customers. So yes, we do expect that we see the our product in the market next year.
Now, are you free to tell us who your partners are, who these, what manufacturers are going to be adopting this science?
We work with several of well-known battery manufacturers. You would recognize them. Unfortunately, I'm not at liberty at this point to release their names.
Okay, but I would think that when you're going to bring this to market, it seems to me that every battery manufacturer going is going to want to be doing business with you. They're going to increase the efficiency of their batteries 30 to 40%. That's the most dramatic advance in batteries, I think, that has come along ever in just one big leap. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, and we're looking forward to all the press that will be generated by those announcements.
Yeah, well, so, and when are those announcements going to be made?
I think as soon as the qualification cycles have successfully been completed, you should see those announcements.
Okay, Jürgen, thank you much. Once again, we've heard this news story break on the Science News Radio Network long before other people break the story on the exciting advances in batteries, the most exciting advance in batteries in years and years and years. Don't expect to hear the formal announcement until the spring. And Jürgen has promised to come back in this program and speak to us more about the exciting things that his company is doing in the months ahead. Right now, we want to talk to some people that are going to be at the IEEE Energy Conference at the, beginning a week from today. Right now, I want to introduce you to Tom Beckwith. He's the CEO of Beckwith Electric and is going to be exhibiting at the IEEE Energy Conference in Boston, which is about a week away now. And you'll really enjoy meeting Tom and his people. Tom has got a real exciting story about, he's developed electronic controls, and I want him to kind of tell us all about it. Tom, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, these electronic controls, tell me, you know, it's for the smart grid. Is that right?
That is correct. And we're primarily focused in a distribution area, the smart grid, that takes the energy from the transmission lines and distributes to residential, commercial, industrial customers of the power companies. And the controls that we and protections that we manufacture are devices that protect, monitor, and control the large components. In the distribution area, primarily we're talking about the transformers and the feeder, the power lines that go out to the customers. And so these protect the transformer that's supplying the power and protect the power lines that go out to the customers. And then control devices within that area that control primarily voltage and a factor that's called VARs. And this factor has a tremendous capability to save energy in the distribution of power.
All right, can you kind of give us an explanation? Now, keep in mind, everybody who listens to this program is smarter than me, and everybody who's on this program is smarter than me, but I really want to drill down a little bit and tell us why these controls are necessary and why they're useful.
Well, I guess, again, the devices we put into the distribution network, they're fairly, I'm not going to say they're boring devices, but they're sort of out-of-the-way devices that are up on poles out in the distribution grid and in the small distribution substations.
Mm-hmm.
But we put very high-speed communications into devices, which is one of the foundations of the smart grid. So we're talking 100 megabit per second Ethernet, which is lightning speed. And we've also put capabilities in these devices, recording and monitoring and what we call sequence of events and oscillography, into these devices that had never been in there before. These capabilities are normally found in very high-level protective relays, protecting large generators like we do. We protect 1,200-megawatt generator nuclear plants, so we have a fairly ominous responsibility in that area, and obviously the capabilities in those devices are extremely sophisticated and high-tech. We've actually put that technology in these controls that are out there in the distribution grid because one of the promises of the smart grid philosophies is to be able to provide more reliable energy, improve the quality of the power that's being delivered, and that's what we can do with these capabilities. We can record and alarm and monitor on events so the power companies immediately know what's happening and allows them to respond much faster in a much more instructed way. So that's the real big news. The communication, to communicate from these devices on poles and in small substations, and then the ability to really measure what's going on with the power that's being delivered to the customers. We're talking about the voltage and the VAR controls. The VAR is a measurement of the loss of power, to say it in an easy way, the loss of power in the grid.
Mm-hmm.
We like a VAR level that's been compensated, and in doing that, there's a device put on the pole. It's called a capacitor.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it's not the flux capacitor from Back to the Future. It's a capacitor on a pole, and we control the switching on and off of that capacitor. Now, that in closing that, it offsets the effect of motors, the air conditioning motors and all the motors out in the system, and produces a power factor, it's called, so that the energy down the line is reduced and is reduced by a significant amount. And so this compensation of everybody's motor loads is done with this equal and opposite effect of this device called a capacitor. And when they're working in conjunction correctly, they save a tremendous amount of energy that now does not have to be sent down the lines, and it's only the energy that does the actual work of the power that reaches its destination. So it's tremendous energy savings.
And this has really been kind of a new development for Beckwith Electric. I understand you started out, 30 years ago or something. Your father started the business. Can you kind of get into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, my mom and my dad and my sister and myself started the business in a suburb of Chicago back in 1967. That's a little over 40 years ago, I guess.
Oh, wow.
And we had an idea to bring electronics into the power industry, which back at the time was using electromechanical mm-hmm. type devices. And my father had worked at General Electric Company for a number of years and in the electric power industry, and wanted to start his own company and got us all together. And we started in a garage in a house in Mount Prospect, Illinois in 1967.
Wow. So, and you tell me that your dad took apart a computer and studied it and looked it all over, and can you explain that to us? How did that happen?
Well, let's fast forward from 1967 till the beginning of the computers. Apple came out with their 2C, and my dad, being an engineer, bought the first one on the block, and then 15 minutes later, again, being an engineer, had it all taken apart,
mm-hmm.
Looking at the cards and then put it back together playing with the software, and a couple weeks later came into the company and said, guess what, we're not using the electronic techniques we've been using for the past so many years. It's all going to be done in a microprocessor. And we looked at him saying, what?
Wow.
And that's what we did. We developed a computer-based electronic control back then, and then subsequently electronic protective relays. And now the industry has embraced that over the last, 30 years now. And everything's microprocessor-based today. Controls, monitoring, protection, metering, it's all microprocessor based on a little computer that's inside, as you know, inside the device. So that was the major feature that Dad brought into the table back in 1981. The Department of Energy gave us a grant for the first ever microprocessor relay, and that's how we got our start in that area of the business.
Well, a lot of people that listen to this program are entrepreneurs or would-be entrepreneurs or investors or that sort of thing, and they're very interested in success stories and how things come about, and I understand that your business now has just really taken off, and at some time or other, you decided to move out of Chicago and down to Largo, Florida. How do you run this operation from Largo, Florida?
Well, actually, we're right in the middle of the Tampa Bay area, and it was, I think, a very good thing that we moved back in 1973 to the Tampa Bay area, because it was in the center of the military aerospace industry, so we moved down and we were right in the middle of the best engineers, quality control techniques, manufacturing techniques. I mean, just the latest and greatest technology was supporting the aerospace and military industry down here in 1973. And so we've been blessed by a tremendous wealth of expertise that's available to us down here in Largo, Florida.
Yeah, I guess Honeywell is down there in that area, isn't it? Are they still there and some of the other companies?
They're sort of still here. That's not, it hasn't been kind of in the last few years, but the area down here, the building, the facility down here, but E-Systems, ECI, Honeywell, a number of companies were down here, and when they had their downturns, we had opportunities to hire their engineers, and we paid them good, so we kept them. And that ended up being a real blessing, a real, real good, fortunate move for us.
Now, you're down in Largo, Florida. So, who are your customers?
Well, they're all over the world. We sell to probably every electric power entity in the United States and Canada, investor-owned utilities, electric co-ops, municipals, government agencies like TVA, Bureau of Reclamation, Bonneville Power. But we also sell overseas. We've got significant markets in to the Japanese companies, South Africa, China, Mexico. There's some areas of the world. I mean, we're small companies still, so we focus on the areas where our message is received, and it's been received extremely well. India is another great customer of ours. So we've got significant. We got an export award last year for the in our regional area. The Department of Commerce gave us an export award, and our exports are about 26% of our sales annually.
Wow, exports are 26% of your sales, and you probably see that growing too, because there's so many developing nations coming along, right?
Yeah, we do. That's been very good for us. The other thing that's been really good for us. Is we've been sort of preaching smart grid for a number of years. The industry's actually been involved in distribution automation for a number of years, but all of a sudden, with the government funding recently, ka-ching, here comes the money, so it's now become the buzzword, smart grid. And prior to this, we had embarked on a development of expanded technology in the areas of controls and protection and monitoring and metering and power quality for devices in the distribution network, and just had completed our designs when all of this broke loose. And it's I tell people we were trying to leapfrog the competition, and it's really nice when the frog lands just when everybody says, hey, that's what I want. And so we've been doing extremely well. God has blessed us tremendously in about the last year, so we're enjoying the ride.
It's so much fun when things, all the hard work and all the preparation and everything else, all of a sudden just comes together at one time, and then you're then in demand, and that makes it really pretty sensational. So when you're in Boston, you're hope to meet some new clients and customers and to make a lot of friends, and we're sure going to look forward to meeting you. That's going to be really, really a pleasure, Tom. Who you're going to be there, and who all are you bringing with you?
Well, Steve Fisher is a new regional technical sales and application engineer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we actually, he had just retired from Duke Energy.
Okay.
And at Duke Energy, he was the manager of distribution, and he, I guess, had about 850 people reporting to him at his position at Duke. So we're very blessed to have him as a new regional application sales engineer, and he will be at this show up in Boston.
Okay, you're going to be there too, though, is that right, or is he going to be there lonesome?
I'm pretty sure I'm going to be there. Sometimes things come up on my schedule, but I've got every intention of being there.
All right, that'll be really wonderful to meet you and him, and we're sure looking forward to it. I know that IEEE sincerely appreciates your support as we move very strong into the energy field, and so it's highly appreciated that you're supporting the event, and we sure look forward to seeing you at the event in Boston on the 27th, 28th, and 29th of this month. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. Good day.
Okay, now to our guest. I want to introduce you to Peter Rubin. He's a chairman of May Rubin Technology Incorporated, and we're going to get a good dose of what's so important about thermally driven refrigeration cycles and a bunch of other stuff. Now, don't run away. This is really interesting stuff. Welcome to the program, Peter.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Can you tell us what May Rubin Technologies does, especially, and how you came about, and why you're so important to the energy conference? I understand you're making a presentation at the IEEE Energy Conference here coming up shortly, and we want to know about what you're going to present.
Well, okay. First of all, May Rubin Technologies is a small company created about 5 years ago to incubate new technologies. And our focus is on clean energy, clean water, and the nexus of the two, because they're very interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the primary technologies we're working on is the one you mentioned, the thermally driven refrigeration cycle. And that design concept is what we will be presenting at the IEEE meeting.
Well, now, what exactly is thermally driven refrigeration cycles? Is this something to do with refrigerating transmission lines so they don't heat up, or working with the new superconducting lines or something? Can you explain that to us?
Sure. A refrigeration cycle is absolutely ubiquitous throughout society. We use thermocycles, in our refrigerators and our air conditioning. That's where we're most introduced to it.
Sure.
But it's used in many other ways throughout society, and in terms of various heat pumps that are often used for distillation and so on. But all of these, 99% of them probably, let's say not all, 99% are electrically driven. They are a reciprocating piston compressor driving the refrigerant fluid through its cycle, and the cycle being an evaporation, change of state, sucks in heat, and then condensing, change of state back to a liquid, gives off the heat in the condenser. And that cycle you need to keep that refrigerant moving through that cycle, and that energy, that drive energy, is provided electrically almost all the time. Now, there are some thermally driven cycles out there today, like absorption chillers, that use heat directly. They do not take heat, turn it into electricity, and then use the electricity to drive the cycle. They use the heat directly to drive the refrigeration cycle. And there's a great energy savings potentially in that, because it takes 3 watts of some high-grade like thermal energy, like combusting natural gas or coal, to produce 1 watt of electricity. So there's a great loss. We lose two-thirds of the energy.
Okay.
If we had an efficient refrigeration system,
yeah,
we could use that thermal energy directly and avoid that loss.
Well, I've been given the cue. We have to take a break, but we'll be back to expand more on that thought right after this. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, We're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Alan Loy McGinnis. Each of us is the accumulation of our memories.